This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, I'm June Grosso. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Tuesday, December 3rd, Amplify CEO Christian Magoon discusses Cyber Monday results and the continued growth of online retail.
We're likely to see record holiday shopping. Some forecasts believe that this year will grow about 4%.
And former UK Defense Secretary Michael Fallon discusses the latest developments at the ongoing NATO summit.
I think we need to remember that the threats we're facing are the same both sides of the Atlantic.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
American shoppers set a record for Cyber Monday. They spent $9.4 billion online. That's up almost 20% from a year ago, and it boosted an already robust holiday shopping season. Bad weather across the continental U.S. may have helped. It gave consumers plenty of reason to shop from their homes. For more analysis, Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney spoke with Christian Magoon, CEO of Amplify ETFs.
I think, 50-year unemployment, steady wage growth is really helping the consumer be confident here. And of course, the big area of growth has been online retail. While total sales may be up about 4%, online retail is trending up maybe 15 to 16%. So that's going to be the sweet spot for investors, and we think for those looking for to kind of ride this retail trend, both for growth, but also for kind of the trend of going online versus in store.
Christian, I'm looking right now at the holdings of iBuy, which is the ETF that you run, with about $250 million of assets under management. I'm just looking, Peloton, is that a retail stock? That's your top holding, according to this.
That's right. So it's a newly added member of the ETF. And really the criteria, Lisa, is that a company has to have 70% or more of their revenue coming from online sales. And Peloton fits that that criteria. Most people think of Amazon as being, kind of the primary online retailer, but, Amazon is just one of many. We've actually had more performance and alpha generated in the last year from companies like Carvana, Shopify, VIP Shop, all of those companies up between 130 and 190% this year. iBuy is unique from an online retail ETF because it is not market cap weighted, it's equal weighted. And we do have that revenue test. So we think that you're getting access to a lot of unique names that maybe you don't necessarily know. I think Peloton is one that people know right now, but the Carvanas of the world, VIP Shop, Ocado, those names have a nice impact and have been an alpha driver for the fund, which is a 5-star rated Morningstar fund and the number one performer in the consumer cyclical category over the last 3 years.
I will just say, Paul, it's interesting to see what retail, online retail, consists of. It consists of food and getting cars to take you places, right? I mean, it's Grubhub, it's getting Lyft, Uber, and then when you feel really guilty about not moving around, you go bike and you do Peloton.
You go do Peloton there, right. So got you covered. Hey, Christian, so I know there's one less shopping week here for this holiday period relative to last year. What kind of risk is that for some of these retailers and some of the ETFs that track them?
Yeah, it definitely is a risk. I mean, we're 6 days less because the holiday shopping season started later, with Thanksgiving being 6 days later than last year. So, one risk is bad weather, frankly, because we have a compressed time period. And we've actually now seen that a little bit on Black Friday and Cyber Monday. I think you guys experienced it yesterday a little bit. And the interesting stat we're seeing from Adobe Analytics, which really tracks the 100 largest online retailers, is that states that had bad weather, 2 inches or more of snow, saw an uptick in online retail sales by between 7 and 9%. So we're seeing that brick and mortar kind of face this headline risk of bad weather where people stay in, but it actually turns into a tailwind for online retailers. Also, this trade issue is definitely something that could impact some consumer confidence. In the last 4 months, we've seen it trending downward, still in a very healthy range, but it's something to watch, particularly as we've heard President Trump back away from maybe maybe the urgency of doing a trade deal here by the end of the year.
Christian, you talked about the good performance of iBuy over the past 3 years, and certainly the shares of stocks that you have, the shares of companies that you have in your portfolio have done very well, the likes of Expedia or the Etsy, Lyft, Uber, Netflix. That, however, is getting called into question now because of how high the valuations are. And this question of, yes, this is the new model, but perhaps there has been too much capital put into these particular companies. How do you respond to the valuation questions?
Well, it's definitely a challenge because when you look at maybe the counterparts of brick and mortar, they have very low valuations, but of course there's the risk they're going out of business. So when we look at the valuations of these growth companies, you know, their PEG ratios are, we think, are still attractive. You know, right now there's still about 11% market share of online retail as opposed to all retail sales in the U.S. In China, for example, that's over 20% market share. We think many of these companies are going to double or triple their market share or their sales over the next 3 to 5 years as online retail continues to emerge. Right now, going back to 1999, online retail has grown about a 19% average compounded annual growth rate. So when we look at these companies, we actually think that over the next 3 to 5 years, if they double or triple their sales, that these valuations will actually look potentially like values.
That was Christian Magoon, CEO of Amplify ETFs and manager of the Amplify Online Retail ETF, iBuy. Coming up, former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson. This is Bloomberg. From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokerage Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. President Trump's new plan to take on the Mexican cartels has the AMLO government crying foul. Bloomberg's David Westin discussed the impact with former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson.
What's going on with the drug cartels?
Well, unfortunately and tragically, the murder of the U.S. citizens is a reflection of a larger wave of violence caused by these cartels. That's been going on for some time now, and it's correct to characterize it as a security issue for Mexico and the United States. Mexico is stretched when it comes to its own security. They've committed a lot to helping the Trump administration with border security on our southern border, but the cartels present a much, much larger threat, and they are probably the largest economic power in that country. And so addressing the cartels, and I know we've tried to do this before, requires a sustained effort on behalf of both the Mexican and the United States governments.
So this is not unique to AMLO, to Lopez Obrador, the president down there.
No, it's
now.
Not.
This long predated him. Other presidents have tried to take on the drug cartels. It's been very, very difficult. But have we, to any extent, made the situation worse by putting so much pressure on the Mexican government, on our southern border, and for that matter, on their southern border,
yes,
to keep people from coming across from Central America?
David, it is definitely the case that by prevailing upon the Mexican government to step up the security on their southern border with Central America, they have committed resources, their National Guard, to our border security and diverted that away from their traditional law enforcement counter-narcotics efforts. That is definitely true. It would surprise a lot of people to know that Mexico has almost no border patrol as we know it, you know, the border patrol agents on our southern border. Mexico has almost none of that. In 2014, the Obama administration prevailed upon the Mexicans to do more on their southern border with Central America, but they were really stretched to do that. They only have like several hundred people committed to that effort, and so to enhance it, they have to divert resources away from law enforcement.
We're talking with Jay Johnson, the former Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. What could the United States do to help? I mean, there's talk now that we might declare the drug cartels a terrorist organization. What would that mean in practical effect? Did that allow us to do things, to actually go after them?
Well, there's a lot we can do. Mexico is very, very sensitive to a U.S. military presence in their country. There's a lot we can do cooperating in law enforcement, devoting our own resources, DEA, FBI, perhaps even at the state level. This idea of designating the cartels a foreign terrorist organization, my first question would be, to what end?
Yeah.
For what purpose? Is there an enhanced authority that the U.S. government would get by doing so? And the answer is probably no. There's a lot we can do in law enforcement. Supporting drug dealing is already a federal crime. There are many sanctions in place already for doing business with the cartels. So, designating them a foreign terrorist organization sounds good, but you have to ask yourself, what additional authorities does that give the U.S. government? And I would say almost none, if any.
President Trump has clearly made this a high priority, that wall and having security across the southern border. And there's a lot of, I think, political support for that notion across the country, Democrats and Republicans, that we should have secure borders. Are we making progress? Are we better off today than the day he came to office in terms of our southern border?
Interesting question. So this year, we saw numbers of apprehensions, and apprehensions are how we measure total attempts across the border, of 100,000 a month. That's higher than anything I saw while we were in office in the Obama administration. The highest I saw was May 2014. That was 60,000 in 1 month. 100,000, over 100,000 is way worse. And there are people out there, objective observers, who say that one of the reasons it got so high is when the president ended family separation in a very public way, it actually had a boomerang effect that caused people to sort of run for the exits last summer. The ultimate answer, David, is addressing the underlying poverty and violence in the three Central American countries. The lesson learned for me dealing with this problem for 3 years is you can do a lot of things on our southern border to secure our border, to enhance enforcement, but you've got to address the problem at the source. And as long as the poverty and violence exist in those three countries, we're going to continue to be dealing with this problem over and over again.
We're talking about Jay Johnson, former Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. As you look at the situation right now, what is the leadership situation for the department that you used to run? There have been a lot of turnover, I think it's fair to say. Do we have a permanent secretary, a replacement for you?
No, we have another acting secretary, Chad Wolf. He is President Trump's fifth Secretary of Homeland Security. And there's turnover not just at the secretary level, but at almost every other senior level position in the department. And that's not good. That's not good for the cabinet level department devoted to protecting the homeland and the American people on the 1 yard line. You know, our military, our intelligence community protects the American people on the 40, the 50. Homeland Security protects us at the end zone on the 1 yard line. And to have this kind of leadership churn is not good. It's not healthy for the organization or for Homeland Security.
Once again, we're speaking with Jay Johnson, the former Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Give us a broader sense, though, beyond the southern border with Mexico. As you look at the possible threats to U.S. national security, what's at the top of your list?
Climate change.
Climate change
at the top of my list, absolutely. My top three threats to our security are climate change, climate change, climate change. Now, beyond that, of course, the
opioid crisis. Explain why that is. What is the specific threat to our security from climate change? How does that work?
Severe weather impacts on aging infrastructure, in particular, present, in my judgment, a security threat. Not just a threat to our environment, but a security threat. And so long as we fail to address aging infrastructure, and so long as we fail to address the larger problem of global warming and climate change, this presents a long-term security issue.
That was former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson. Coming up, Michael Fallon, former UK Defense Secretary. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live from the Interactive Broker Studio in New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm June Grosso. President Trump suggested penalties may be on the way for NATO alliance members who fail to meet funding targets on defense. And for more analysis on NATO, Bloomberg's Guy Johnson and Vonnie Quinn spoke with Michael Fallon, former UK Secretary of State for Defense.
You did three NATO summits. Does this one feel different? It seems as if there are some quite significant divisions, particularly between some core countries like the United States and France and Turkey.
Well, you do get issues. There seem more of them this time, Turkey, France, and the United States. But NATO's always changed. It's adapted over the years to new challenges. And I think we need to remember that the threats we're facing are the same both sides of the Atlantic, whether it's, you know, Russian aggression, or whether it's the threat from cyber, or whether it's any other kind of challenge. The same threat to security is on both sides of the Atlantic, and we do need to be working together on it.
Is China a NATO role? That conflict seems to be becoming greater and greater in everybody's consciousness. At the moment, it is a trade conflict, but it could easily become a military conflict. Does NATO have a global role that could include what happens with China?
Well, NATO is already global in the sense it's been operating in Afghanistan, for example. It's got a minor role in Iraq. And NATO is looking at the other domains now, getting into space and into cyber. So inevitably, I think NATO is going to become more global. NATO has partnership arrangements with Australia, for example, on the other side of the globe. So I do see NATO evolving, and that's the point. NATO has always changed, and it's dealing with things now it didn't deal with 30 years ago. We didn't have international terrorism on the scale that we're seeing it now. NATO has to respond to that as well.
Secretary, there are obvious schisms within NATO among the member countries, and clearly that's only going to continue, particularly post-Brexit and so on. Do you see those schisms ever going away? Do you see an alliance that's stronger, or do you see another EU military popping up?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, it's a big alliance. It contains 29 countries now, so inevitably there are differences of view. But the threats to NATO now are really 360 degrees. So I think you'll find that whatever the differences are, we have more in common in meeting those challenges together. And really, there isn't a replacement. NATO is the only alliance that brings the United States and Canada together with the European allies. There's no other forum for doing that. And the EU can't do it. Some of the EU countries are neutral countries. The EU does not have a military structure. So in the end, you know, I don't think there's any point simply duplicating NATO. We have to keep working at NATO, spend more on it, and continue to adapt it to the new threats of today.
Is it fair to say that the US still dominates the defence approach at NATO, and does that need to change?
Well, the US dominates the funding of NATO. And throughout my political life, American presidents have been asking the Europeans to pick up more of the burden. And it's also important to remember that America in the last 2 or 3 years, whatever the rhetoric, has been deploying troops in Poland, has been assisting Europe with missile defense in Romania. So I don't doubt the American commitment to European security, because as I was saying to Guy, these threats to our security, whether it's international terrorism or Russian aggression or Chinese ambition, these threats involve us all, whichever side of the Atlantic we're on.
Switch gears a little bit. This is being held in London. There is cause for concern within the Conservative Party that what is happening with this NATO summit with the President here could impact the upcoming election on the 12th. What is your assessment of the outcome of that election? There has been a narrowing in the polls of late. Do you think Boris Johnson and co are heading for a working majority? What kind of a number should we be thinking about?
Well, at the moment, I think we are heading for a working majority, and I think that's really important for the security of our country, because we're fighting a Labour Party that for the first time in my lifetime is being led by somebody who doesn't really believe in NATO. I think he's previously described NATO as more of a threat than an alliance. So this is a very important election for our security.
That was Michael Fallon, former UK Defence Secretary. And coming up, Stephanie Kelly, senior global economist with Aberdeen Standard Investments. This is Bloomberg.
With a Bloomberg Business of Sports report, I'm Michael Barr. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf wants Major League Baseball to rethink a restructuring plan that would affect three minor league teams in his state. The professional baseball agreement between Major League Baseball and the National Association of Professional Baseball Leagues expires after the 2020 season. The restructuring proposal would lead to 42 minor league teams being dropped from circuits. Major league teams say they spend nearly $500 million annually in salary to support the minor leagues, but get back only $18 million,
Wolf says the current proposal will put players and employees out of jobs and be economically harmful to host communities. Former women athletes are donating millions of dollars to help build facilities and scholarships. It comes as the 50th anniversary of Title IX approaches. The federal gender equality law came into play in 1972. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. Let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Ed Corey on KFBK in Sacramento. I'm reporting California investigators say PG&E had a lack of oversight that led to a live wire falling and igniting the deadliest blaze in California history.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on WoWo in Fort Wayne. Cleveland Cliffs agreed to buy AK Steel for about $1.1 billion.
I'm Tom Busby, and on KYW in Philadelphia, I'll be reporting on how bad weather helped send Cyber Monday sales to a new record high.
I'm Elisa Parenti. On WBBM in Chicago, I'm reporting locally based Boeing's 737 MAX disasters may end up changing the FAA's process for certifying aircraft.
Thanks, Elisa. Representatives from 200 countries are gathering in Madrid for 2 weeks of talks on global warming. And Aberdeen Standard Investments is out with a new extensive report on how different nations are dealing with carbon and what it means for investors. Bloomberg's David Westin spoke with one of the authors of the report, senior global economist for Aberdeen, Stephanie Kelly.
Explain your report. I've read through it. It's fascinating what it does. But explain what you did, what you were trying to do, and what your methodology was.
Yeah, of course. I mean, great to be here and such a great time to talk about this, I think, given what's going on in Madrid this week. You know, the background to this research is basically, you know, clearly investors have woken up to the importance of climate change and of addressing climate change and the role that private capital can play in trying to assist in the energy transition. However, it tends to be very company focused. You know, investors tend to focus on what are companies doing, what are their carbon emissions. But we think it's really important to bear in mind companies don't operate in a vacuum here. You know, legislation, regulation, that's where climate policy is set, and that's set by politicians. So what we wanted to do with this research was really dig into the relationship between carbon emissions and the impact that that can have, or the relationship that might have with elements of the economy, with policy, to try and better understand what are those relationships. But then crucially, and this is really what we were seeking to give to the investment community to kind of lead on this, is to provide a framework to incorporate climate policy risk and opportunity into the investment strategy approach. So essentially, if you've got a kind of a bottom-up strategy, this will be complementary, providing this top-down understanding of what is the climate policy risk and opportunity.
And you focused in particular on Europe, the United States, China, and India, which, as I recall, you said account for about 60% of all the carbon emissions in the world. How did you go about rating those three countries/areas?
So the way we do it is through a framework that can be applied to any country. As you say, we chose the biggest emitters because they seem the most relevant, but our intention is, over time, to roll this out to more and more countries and regions. So essentially the way we compare across is because we have four steps in the framework. Essentially you can think of these almost as a checklist, right? Questions investors should be asking themselves about climate policy environment. The first is about key characteristics in these countries. So what kind of climate, what kind of weather do they have? Do they rely on industry? Because we know industry is associated with carbon emissions. Do they have a lot of coal or oil? Those kind of things set what we call the base level for emissions. Then step two and three look at the politics and the policy. And here that's super important because the United States is a great example of the politics and the role that that plays in, you know, the failure to address climate change, because we know that, and particularly the Republican Party, climate change just isn't an important issue for voters, therefore it's not an important issue for the party itself. And then the fourth step is to say, given what we know about politics, about policy, about the preconditions for carbon emissions, can we access this market? We're investors, first and foremost. Can we access this market? Can we contribute to the transition? And where are the opportunities? Which sectors are most exposed? And how do we go about making the most of those opportunities?
So we're talking with Aberdeen Standard Investments senior global economist. She's Stephanie Kelly. So Stephanie, I want to dig down a little bit on the U.S. side, because it's not quite right to say Americans don't care about it. There's a wide range. There's almost like two different camps within the United States, where you have liberal Democrats who really think it's terribly important and conservative Republicans who really don't think it's important enough. Isn't part of the problem just division? It's not that the United States is all together and not caring about climate.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely not the case that it's all United States voters. As you said, we know, and we dig into this in our report, that Democratic voters are very concerned, engaged on the issue, particularly the more liberal end of the Democratic Party. But so long as you have that deep division between Republicans and Democrats, as we see in the rest of the policy sphere, what you end up with is policy gridlock, right? We know the challenges you have between the House, the Senate, and the White House passing legislation and passing regulation. But what's interesting is then, because we know that, right, and that's a challenge, but where's the opportunity? Well, the opportunity from our perspective is if you look to the state level, and those states where there are more kind of Democrat-led tend to be more inclined towards incentivizing climate change, incentivizing renewable infrastructure projects, and creating an environment in which the energy transition can flourish. And we think that it's at the state level you can start to really find those opportunities.
Stephanie, you have an election coming up over there. You're in Edinburgh right now, but you have a UK election about to come up. Let's turn now to that election. And let me ask you specifically about climate, more generally about the economy. To what extent will that really factor into the results in the election, or is it really just all about Brexit at this point?
I think the UK election this time around is very focused on Brexit. It's obviously the key issue that is going to determine the UK economy for the next 10 years, 20 years, and voters are well aware of that. However, what we're seeing is kind of a delineation whereby the Conservative Party, which has been in government, is polling pretty well. The Labour Party, which is the kind of the traditionally left-wing party, has started to kind of pick up a little bit of momentum, but is still trailing a lot. And so for investors, what that means is, yes, we think that you were likely to get a Conservative government in December, but worth bearing in mind, for UK assets, the roller coaster may not be done, because 2020 brings with us new cliff edge moments for Brexit, and I think that's going to create real challenges for sterling in particular.
We have the potential roller coaster with Brexit with respect to the United Kingdom. What about the potential roller coaster with respect to Europe, and particularly France right at the moment, with President Trump now saying we're going to have tariffs, 100% tariffs on $2.4 billion worth of goods? How do you evaluate the risk of U.S.-EU trade friction?
I think it's clearly been there, kind of bubbling under the surface, and has its moments of volatility where it kind of pops up. And we've seen that not just, you know, in the last couple of days, but actually in the last couple of years. We've had particularly auto tariffs has been the focus. I think that the challenge you have is because these tariffs are kind of aimed at trying to counteract the effects of the taxation on tech firms, US tech firms, it's kind of in some ways a little bit idiosyncratic. But I would say overall, it's worth bearing in mind that the US and the EU are, you know, fundamentally underlying all of the kind of momentary frictions allies. Where I tend to be more concerned and tend to be watching much more closely is around US-China relations, because we know there that strategic rivalry continues to be the undercurrent of these trade negotiations, which makes it harder to talk about a kind of a consistent relationship over time.
So Stephanie, from your perspective over there in Europe, is what we're seeing right now with trade and the uncertainty over trade, is it really attributable to President Trump, or is he more of a symptom of a broader phenomenon where there's increasing really doubt about globalization the way it has been distributed across the population?
I think that that's a really important point, and one that we tend to underline a lot, which is there has been, with the kind of polarization and fragmentation of political systems across, I would say, Western democracies in Europe, in the US, this kind of movement towards more domestic focus, trying to find new ways to compensate those people who feel that they've really not benefited from globalization. I think that that's an issue for all governments that they're trying to tackle, but unfortunately it's not clear what the policy solution is, and that's why you're seeing in Europe the increase in populism, and in the US, kind of, you know, we often say President Trump's election reflects underlying concerns that already existed in the US around the Chinese economy and the extent to which that is embedded with the US economy.
That was Stephanie Kelly, senior global economist with Aberdeen Standard Investments. And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. You can see all of our best work at NIBESTGO on the Bloomberg Terminal. Our show is produced by Caroline O'Brien. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on cryptocurrencies. They're going up and down, but are they getting anywhere with Bloomberg's Olga Karif?
The situation.
It's the same existential question of, will Bitcoin be sort of the dominant cryptocurrency, or will something else pass it in popularity and sort of make Bitcoin either a niche product or irrelevant?
The background.
Basically, wherever you look globally, there is something happening where the regulators are trying to reduce illegal uses and to reduce any problems associated with crypto.
The argument.
So it's still hard to say what cryptocurrency's future role will be. Potentially, it could help modernize and speed up financial transactions. But exactly what shape and form that will take is still remains to be seen.
For more on cryptocurrencies or other quick takes, go to Bloomberg.com, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.